You're listening to the Live Talk with Lamb podcast hosted by me, Todd Shapiro. Episode 6 with Brad Lamb, and we really enjoy doing this podcast, and we're so grateful for all the support we have from it. Thank you all for downloading it and listening and tweeting and giving us a...
Is anyone actually listening to this?
Well, we're pretending they are.
Okay.
We got 6. I know our team is.
We have a listener.
Developing them, and this is your game now. We haven't really talked about the entire process of developing because it seems like it would be a difficult one. For those who are really intrigued by it, would you mind sharing how that goes for you?
No, I'd be delighted to tell people what it's like to be a developer.
So why don't we just make this simple and start with step one?
Well, step one is you have to decide that you're going to be a person of many talents because you're really, I liken it to, it's like a film producer, but a film producer that is really, really involved in the production of the film. So maybe a former director of a film that became a producer, like a guy like Steven Spielberg maybe, and is actually on set all the time and directing the director to some extent. That kind of thing, right? So it's you have to have a lot of knowledge about a lot of things. And you have to have a personality where you're not going to win all the time. You're just not going to. And you have to get used to, put it into a baseball analogy, you got to be used to hitting a lot of singles and striking out sometimes. And every now and then you're hitting home run, but everything you do will not be home run. And when you set a pro forma, which is the budget for the film or for the project, you have to realize that it's a target, but it's likely not going to be met. There will be setbacks along the way.
So what is the first step to being a developer? What's the first thing you look for?
Well, the first thing you have to do is find a property. So you need to be able to, and it's not easy to find a property because there's a lot of people looking, right? There's thousands and thousands of developers on various scales and levels. And there's lots of pension funds and life cos and so on that aren't developers, but they're investors that are always looking for land too. So it's very competitive. So you need to have good contacts in the land procurement business, which means you need to know a lot of real estate brokers, commercial brokers, and they need to believe you're a serious guy or woman. In other words, they bring you something, you're not going to shit the bed on it. And so...
They don't want to waste their time.
They don't waste their time, and these are huge transactions, and they don't want to waste a potential transaction on someone that's not going to go forward with it. So... buying land and commercial property is a completely different organism than buying a house or a condo. A lot of property is never for sale. Most commercial transactions are never publicly for sale. You wouldn't even know they're available. They're done through an elite group of people, the commercial brokers in any city. They control the product, they control the sellers, they control the buyers, and they put them together. So the first thing is it's tough to break into that class. It's a very tough class to get respect from. It took me a decade to really be taken seriously. Now at this point, I get all the offers. I get all the stuff brought to me. I don't get the stuff that's $200 million brought to me, that kind of land. But all the land that's between, you know, $2 million and $50 million crosses my desk, and all the commercial deals of that scale cross my desk. So I get first crack at that. So now you find something you like, you analyze it, you buy it. It's as simple as that.
What's the analysis process in terms of really, can you make money on this piece of land eventually?
If it's a development site, you plan on developing immediately because there's a huge cost to buying and carrying debt on land. So say you're going to do it right away. Parking lot maybe. So there's no income of any sort to justify holding it long term. So what you want to do is you want to make sure that the density, it's otherwise known as FAR, F-A-R, it's basically the number of times of the lot you can cover on the property. So if the lot is 100 by 100 or 10,000 square feet, then if the FAR or the density is 10, that means you can build 100,000 square feet. A Okay. So you can build 100,000 square feet, let's say, on 20 floors. That's what you believe. Now, in Toronto, just specifically in Toronto, you never know that for sure because the city hasn't been rezoned in many, many, many decades. And now virtually every property is called a site-specific zoning, which means you don't really know what you're going to get. So you need to talk to the city. You need to...
Even with precedents being set around it, it could differ?
You never know.
Wow.
You have an idea, but sure. You never really know. So you're taking a chance in Toronto. You're taking a huge chance. Now, today, we don't have something called the Ontario Municipal Board, the OMB. When the OMB was around, more land transactions were taking place because if we thought the city wouldn't participate in our dream and they would fight that, which they are doing that now on almost anything that's brought to them, even with precedent, they're saying, we don't care about precedent. We're bringing it down now to well below precedent. So today, you're in a situation where you have to be more conservative about buying land. When there's an OMB, you can be a bit more aggressive because you can go to court and present your facts. And if your facts are sound, you can win the building you want to do. Regardless of that, you have to decide if it's economically viable. Let's say you do that and it's economically viable. You think you buy it. And you have to finance it. And you don't put, if you're buying a piece of land for $20 million, you don't write a check for $20 million. You probably put about $6 million down, maybe $7 million of cash. You borrow the rest from an institution. It's not going to be a bank. It's going to be a second party. It'll be a life co. It'll be private money. It'll be more expensive institutional money. Because banks don't lend on empty parking lots because there's no income and they don't like taking that risk. You're spending more money to borrow the money than a bank.
Higher interest rates.
Yes. Yeah.
What approximately would an interest rate be for?
In today's marketplace, it could be anywhere from 5 to 12%, depending on who you are.
So then you want to develop that land quick.
Well, if you're paying 12, it means you don't have a high net worth, you don't have a lot of experience, and you got to move quick. Yeah, quickly. If you're more experienced, you might be in the 5-6 area, 5-6.5. But still, it's expensive money. It's interest only money. There's never any principal. Usually, no principal paid off. And you have a time frame of 7 years in and out. So you finance it with an idea that day one this much money, and day out 7 years, everyone's gone.
So you have your land, you have your financing, you have your vision. Obviously, what comes next?
Well, then you have to hire the people that are going to put that vision into reality. So you're going to hire an architect, an interior designer, a planner, a development lawyer, code consultants. You're going to hire wind consultants. You're going to hire environmental consultants, blah, blah, blah. There's like 50 consultants you hire. They all send a proposal. You negotiate the proposal usually based on the size of the project. It's often density-based. Square footage based. And then you sign up those contracts and you start working. So initially, you don't need all the consultants. You need maybe 3 or 4. Architect, you need the planner, you need the lawyer right away. Those are the ones, and maybe a co-consultant, you engage right away. And then you start hiring the other ones as you get more and more close to the architecture and the idea being complete. Then you got to fill in the empty spaces. And once that's done, you submit it to the city for a rezoning.
Is that a pretty unique and small group as well in terms of all those different types of consultants? Is there just a few to select from? I mean, do you have room to negotiate with these people?
It's in Toronto, it's thicker than it would be in other cities because there's a lot of talent here. Like, you know, architecture, there's lots of architects that work regularly in the high-rise business. There's not many I'd hire. Frankly, I mean, I think there's 5 firms I might hire that I think would represent what I wanted to do, the kind of quality of architecture that I'd want to have. I really use one firm now more than anything, but we're looking at using some other firms, but right now I use one firm almost always.
And if you're a newer developer,
Sorry, Todd. And the reason I do that is not just because they're talented, it's because they know what I want. I don't have to start from square one, re-educating them about what my idea is in terms of how the building looks. And I don't mean just the architecture. I mean how it's finished, how it's put together, what it needs to look like, right?
Sure. Helps bring that vision a lot easier to reality.
Yeah.
But when you're a newer developer, when you first started, are you borrowing money to pay for these firms too and consultants as well at first? Or?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. I'll take you through a sample, my first transaction on my own. where I controlled it. I had 66% of this project. So I had operational control. It was a building called Glass, which is on Charlotte. It's just off King and Adelaide, a street called Charlotte. And I bought that property for $4.1 million. And we put $1.5 million down. There was a very good parking lot operating. And at that time, $2.5 or $2.6 million was almost covered by the rent from the parking lot. It was pretty good because, you know, $4 million for a 20,000 square foot parking lot was cheap. Today, sure. That would be $50 million.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. So anyway, so we all put in our share of, I had put in 66% of the money. I think we did that project with $6 million in total. And so I put in three something. And how I got that money was I sold 15 condos, around 15 condos that I owned, and it generated like three something, and I stuck it in, and that was my first on my own kind of thing. We borrowed about another $4 or $5 million, and that money altogether was the money that took us to the finish line to where we could, because we had, you know, the architecture fee was $800,000, and that day it's more now. And you know, blah, 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 all the costs we had to pay. You could never do that development today for that kind of money. You know, you'd need $25 million to develop today. But back then, $6 million of equity and it was a lot of money to me at the time. It was 2003.
So once you get the place designed and your vision now is something you can go and present to the government, how does it, is that when it gets zoned? Is that the next step?
Well, you submit it to the planning department, and then they circle it through their planning area, and various, you know, transportation looks at it. The planner looks at it, all the different areas look, historic department looks at it, if there's something related to, you know,
heritage.
Historic or heritage. I guess they're called heritage, not historic. Anyway, they all look at it. They all touch it. They all make their comments. Urban Design looks at it to see if they think it's pretty. Of course, what the city thinks is pretty, I do not agree with remotely, so we never agree. But in my case, they never agree with what I want to build, and we end up always fighting and going to the OMB. However, and all our projects currently that we have in queue are slated to go to the OMB because the OMB has been grandfathered and continues to live for those fights that started years ago because we're still in the queue of those fights or the disagreements. But there are developers in the city that have never visited the OMB and they work with the city and they end up getting something that they're okay with. What I find is that those are just massive compromises, right? They end up building something that they didn't really want to build. It still works for them financially, and it doesn't look the way they initially wanted it to look. And I just don't want to do that stuff kind of development. So we fight hard to get the buildings that we want to build built. I think they're always reasonable in scale and size and so on, but that's the fight then, and that's the risk, because if you've paid too much money for the land, and let's say you've bought it and you think you're going to get 150,000 square feet, you go to the OMB and you lose, you get 100,000 square feet, or you lose and you have to go back to the city to try to make a deal now and you get 100,000 square feet. You might have overpaid for the land and that could be a problem for your budget, and maybe you're not going to make any money or not enough money for a bank to lend you the money to build it, because they need to know you're going to make money to protect their money, right?
Seems like quite a gamble and a headache, but yet you keep doing it. So obviously you've learned the process well. You know how to make these calculated risks and decisions. Once you've sort of had that big, it seems like at least in your case, a hurdle and a headache within the planning departments and stuff, what is that? So now you're approved. You know, this is what we got going. Or do you start to market before you're approved even?
Well, so the single biggest hurdle is approval stuff. It takes years. To give an idea, the building I'm doing right now that I'm going to break ground or we're just demoing, it's called the Woodsworth. It was previously called the James, and I had to cancel it because it took so long to go through the city that we had to redo it, start over. So I'm now going to demo the building. It's over 4 years since we bought the land. And now we're selling it again in today's marketplace. We had to cancel it like a year and a half ago because it was we didn't have any of the things in our contract we had to have. We didn't have financing, zoning, or sales to qualify to build it. And plus, the sales that we did have were way too cheap, way too low to be able to borrow any money from a bank. No bank would lend any money to build it. This is the single biggest problem we have in Toronto, is how long it takes to take. And by the way, so we took it to the OMB. It took us 2 years to get to the OMB, all the fussing around. It took a year for the OMB to rule, yes, you could go ahead with this project. We got 17. We're going for 18 floors. They gave us 17. A full year ago, year and 1 month ago, we won, and I'm still fighting with the city, even though we won, to get a permit to start it. A year from then. It's absurd, right? So the problem is, that's the single biggest problem in this city. So in the past, I would sell it in advance of zoning because I always felt zoning would ultimately come. But now I will never again sell in advance of zoning, because you just don't know when it's going to happen. And the problem is, the cost of construction are rising so dramatically. The government fees, the city of Toronto is just increasing and grinding us out for fees. $250,000, 25% of any budget is now city of Toronto and province of Ontario taxes and fees.
What do a lot of those fees go to pay that people wouldn't know?
Well, there's Section 37, which is a tax on density. So because there's no real zoning, everything's a tax on density now, because the zoning's 8 stories, you're building 40, but it's 8 stories from 1948 or it's 1972, whatever it is. It's absurd. Then there's also often an arts tax, where just cause you need to pay for the arts. And it's a random number the counselor could come up with if they felt that was something they wanted to get. There's also development fees. Development fees in 2000 were zero. And now a development fee for a one-bedroom is $45,000 for a one-bedroom apartment or a studio, from zero. There's also education levies. By the way, these are all changing. City's all proposing monster changes here. But right now, 10% of the assessed value of the land. So if you buy a piece of land for $10 million and you wait, you're fighting really hard, and 4 years later it gets rezoned, they appraise the land at the time of rezoning, and you pay a 10% tax on the rezoned number, not the number you paid for. The number you paid for is in your pro forma. The number they tax you on is the number they think it's worth at the time they approve it, right? It could be double or triple what you paid for it, they think. And there's no fighting this. There's no fighting this. It is what it is. They tell you the number. You can go talk to I've done it before. I've gone and talked to the two gentlemen that assess it. It's pointless. You'd have to go to the OMB, which doesn't exist anymore, but that's where you'd go to fight it. And it would take a year and a half to get a decision, which you can't wait a year and a half, right? So you're forced to pay it. And that could be anywhere from $3, $4, $5, $6 million, $10 million for a building. It's a lot of money. And by the way, there's more. I could go on and on and on about it, but it's a massive number, and it works out on a one-bedroom apartment that sells for $500,000. $100,000 plus is going to the government for these fees. People understand that the government is making $100,000 plus per unit being sold here. So how can you make housing more affordable? Well, there's a way right there. There's a huge way you could do it.
Wow. I mean, I think it's really good to listen to your candidness and your honesty and your passion behind the business, that a lot of people might not know the headaches, the hurdles, the struggle, really. Listen, you've done well, but you're not going to do it if you can't continue to do well. No one would in any other business. So we really respect that. Brad,
it's not about doing well. I just want to be clear about this. It's not about money and doing well. It's really what it's about, is being having enough autonomy in your business without government, in your face interfering with you. You just can't do your job here.
And I guess I really liked to hear, and I'm sure everyone listening is, you're really proud of leaving a mark in this amazing city and across this country. And I guess to end this, to take satisfaction away from something beyond the money, to leave that mark, how does that feel for you?
So there's two types of developers. I think we've had this talk before when I was on your radio show.
Yeah.
There's developers who come from it from purely financial aspect. They're just managing money. And there's people like me who are entrepreneurial and didn't come from, accounting or law. It came from, I would say, more the art side, where I really love beautiful buildings. Now, we build as beautiful buildings as we can, given that they got to make money and they got to sell, right? We can't. I'd love to build some crazy buildings in the city, but we can't sell them at the numbers that make them work. So we're trying to do the best we can given our limitations. But for me, the number one thing is I'm not doing this if I have to build schlep. And that's why I'm not working in cities where schlep only works. Like I can't work in cities that we can't get certain dollars because the market won't allow it. It's my living, so I'm in it to make money, but it's not the principal reason I'm here. I'm here because I could have stayed selling real estate. I was fine. I'm doing it because I like buildings. I get excited about real estate, excited about beautiful buildings. I want to build the best buildings we can, given our budgets, given our, the fact that people have to be able to buy them and afford them. You know, I've had opportunities to do projects that will deliver something to me that's forgettable. And I understand there are some people that can only live in that. They can only live in what's affordable. That's not my thing. I'm not the guy that's delivering that. That's someone else's job. We want to build beautiful buildings, as beautiful as they can be. And I want to be able to stand there and look at them and go, yeah, yeah, that's a good job. But it's not perfect. Nothing's perfect, but it's good. Each time, I want to do better and make them better. We're always trying to look at new ideas and new ways to make buildings affordable and beautiful.
Thank you all for listening. And just another episode, and we can't wait to bring the next one to you. Thanks, Brad.
Well, hey, no, thank you, Todd.
Appreciate it. If you have any questions for us, please hit us up at info@lamdevcorp.com. That's info@lamdevcorp.com. If you enjoy listening to Live Talk with Lam, make sure to like, comment, and subscribe. Thanks.